This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. I welcome Germanicus, my colleague and friend of many years. He is Marco Vlejos. We're in Londinium. It's the spring of 91 AD. The empire is fine, thank you very much. Domitian is troubled. Our emperor, however, because Augustus, the god Augustus, did such a good job in putting the empire together initially, we feel very confident here in Londinium. Our security, our prosperity, our future, at least the next 100 years, looks to be stable. However, we have a gift or a curse. We can see 20 centuries ahead. And Germanicus and I gather here on the weekends. We don't work. We have Greek freedmen who do all the work on our estates. We gather here to speculate about what is the future for Europe, which is what Rome created for Europe 20 centuries from now during the Ukraine conflict and afterwards. Germanicus, we begin with speculation. What if Ukraine wins? And I don't have a clear definition of what that win will look like, but the perception of winning. Russia stands down, Ukraine stands down, they negotiate in some fashion, and it's perceived that Ukraine has outlasted the Russian Empire. What does Europe look like after that eventuality? Good evening to you, Germanicus.
Good evening, Gaius. And that is, of course, an extremely difficult question to work through, in large part because it remains at this moment, from at least my vantage, through the aperture that I am viewing the world, that is an extremely hypothetical possibility. So the first approach that we must take to the possibility of a Ukrainian victory would be to look at what would be needed for the Ukrainians to win. And I don't mean simply materiel or plans or even intelligence or weather. But what would they need, and what would need to attain in other dimensions of the conflict for them to be successful in this, you know, long advertised, much ballyhooed spring offensive? It would be that every judgment of the Ukrainian boosters, from those in the government to the expert courtier world in Washington, everything that they said and have said about the Russian military would have to be true. In other words, the Russians could not have adapted and learned very much from an entire year of desperately intense operations, and deeply challenging operations, urban warfare being foremost among them. They would not only not have to have learned, but the problems that have been ascribed to the Russian partial mobilization and efforts to find new stocks of weapons, tanks, more shells, etc., would also have to be true, that the Russians cannot produce as many tanks, they cannot refurbish as many tanks, they cannot produce enough shells, they cannot get enough shells from putative suppliers like North Korea, et cetera, et cetera. And in that sense, we have to suspend our disbelief, knowing that much of this is simply not the case. Or it would be an intense surprise after everything we've seen over the course of a year of combat operations. It would have to be thrown out the window, and Russia would have to fail again as it failed in the early spring of last year, and in the entire year that followed, not to have learned or adapted or built up its capabilities. That's one thing that would have to attain. The second thing that would have to attain is that Ukraine would have to have forces sufficiently trained and in sufficient number to be able to actually prosecute an aggressive offensive with strategic objectives, something that the Ukrainian army has never undertaken and never successfully executed. Ukraine has been fighting a defensive battle for most of the last year, and the only so-called offensives they launched were relatively small incursions against very, very lightly held Russian lines, which were themselves not prepared, without expedient field fortification of any kind. And the Ukrainian forces were able to succeed in lightly populated areas in the Kharkov region and take some territory at enormous expense. And eventually that operation ground to a halt. It lost steam, or as Clausewitzians would say, it reached the culminating point in war. And the second operation that was an offensive operation in Kherson on the other side of the Dnieper was shut down by Russians, and Russians decided to evacuate that entire area on the other bank, on the other side. And as a result, the gains that were made by Ukraine were not gains that they had achieved by defeating Russian forces in battle, but were actually handed in a strategic withdrawal of Russian forces to shore up their front. And then in the period since those autumn attacks or counteroffensives, whatever term you wish to use, but we should try not to use the more extravagant terminology in these cases. Since the autumn, the Russians have mobilized hundreds of thousands of troops and had lots of time to train those who weren't trained, but most of them are trained in the sense that they are reservists. Plus, there have been a lot of volunteers, and there are other forces like the Wagner Group, Chechens, etc. And the result is the Russians have also had, since the autumn, lots of time to prepare fortified lines. There are three successive lines, for example, in Zaporizhia. And these are expedient field fortifications, but they are they're finished fortifications. In other words, they've been made by modern excavators and include all sorts of modern features like concrete pillboxes, dragon's teeth, which are little concrete pyramids to stop tanks, plenty of chevaux de frise and other obstacles, and of course, millions of mines, very deep and wide trenches against tanks. All of this will not stop, as I said last week, a determined and well-orchestrated Ukrainian offensive, but it'll slow it down. And the problem that Ukraine faces is that even with a large formation, which might exceed 80,000 soldiers and would, as is suggested these days, be formed into three separate corps, they would be armored corps, but not have very many tanks. They'd mostly rely on infantry fighting vehicles. We don't know how much artillery they will have by the time this offensive begins. They may have a good stockpile of ordnance to fire. The problem that the Ukrainians face is that they will be attempting something on a far larger scale that they've never done before. They will be using a menagerie, and I use that word deliberately, a menagerie of Western tanks, many of which are very old and weak in terms of their armor protection, and of several different varieties, and they're really quite complex little vehicles or big vehicles. And to have trained up men, however motivated, with whatever boundless zeal is packed within their souls, it still takes more than a year, some say two or three, to become a really proficient tank operator.
What I think I'm hearing is that the Ukrainian victory, whatever it looks like at this point, appears improbable. Is that
well,
a, because I want to move on to the Russian victory.
Yes, and there's one other element, which is that the Russian reserve forces that have been held back and not committed in places like Bakhmut or Avdiivka, for example, form a significant panzer fist, to use the popular term. And so a Ukrainian force that expended itself, again, as I suggested last week, a la the Battle of Kursk in summer 43, can then be potentially enveloped. And an envelopment of a badly brutalized Ukrainian army that is their last army.
You can
the fall of Ukraine.
That improbability still can win. Improbability.
Yes. Let's see how this could win.
All right. I want to turn to the Russian side. I do mention Dunkirk, for example. The Germans win, except they didn't. Things happen.
They did and they didn't. It's unclear even to this day whether or not they could have penetrated the very stout defense that the British and French covering forces gave their lives for.
Agree. The pause on the 23rd and 24th. However, my observation is that it was improbable that the British escape. It was improbable.
Well, we have to remember in Dunkirk, and everyone glosses over this, half the rescued soldiers of the 330,000 were French, and they were immediately returned to the battlefield. So they weren't rescued at all. This is something that is inconceivable to me that people will gloss over this. The only army that was actually saved at Dunkirk was the British Expeditionary
Without
Force.
Its weaponry? Without its heavy weapons?
Without anything. I mean, the Germans...
I understand. I'm just saying improbability. I'm just giving an example of improbability. And
Dunkirk was a terrible defeat. And see, the problem with the Germans pushing it too much at Dunkirk would have meant what the Ukrainians went through in their autumn offensives. It said they'd lose critical people, and if they lost too many people, you know, there was still the whole rest of France to be subdued.
The Germans beat themselves up for the next 50 years because of Dunkirk. So
I don't think they should have. I think they did as much as they could have without compromising.
It's still going on. Third generation. Improbability happens on the battlefield. I want to turn to the Russian side because we're entertaining speculation here. If Ukraine is to win, Germanicus has given us an example of what Ukraine must overcome, and it seems improbable. If Russia is to win when we come back, what must it overcome? This is the Friends of History Debating Society with Germanicus, Michael Vlahos. I am Gaius John Bachelor. We're in Londinium enjoying ourselves. Thank you.